Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the book Angela and Diabola by Lynn Reed Banks. A transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hello, Adam.
Hello, Ren. How are you faring?
I'm sleepy.
You're quite a constitutionally sleepy sort of person.
I have been referred to as a dormouse before.
Is that the dormouse from Alice in Wonderland?
Yeah. Just asleep in a teapot. That's me. if you ever want to imagine me, listeners, just imagine a dormouse sleepily napping in a teapot. And how about you, Adam? What character from Alice in Wonderland would you say most?
Probably the White Rabbit, but hopefully just hustling and bustling, trying to get lesson plans done, rather than the kind of scissor-wielding White Rabbit in Jan Schrankmar's stop-motion animated version, who cuts heads with scissors.
I don't associate cutting off heads with scissors with you. I've known you a while, so...
Yeah. Well, I associate that character with my friend Peter, because when I showed him that film in sixth form, he did chase after me with scissors, pretending to be the White Rabbit. And we're talking about a book with similarly diabolical, maniacal behaviour.
Yeah, this is Angela and Diabola, which is the pronunciation that I'm going with. Because that's how I read it, by Lynn Reed Banks from 1997. Lynn Reed Banks' most famous children's books were the Indian in the Cupboard series that got adapted into a film that I never saw, but I did see the trailer often because it was on one of my most watched VHS tapes as a kid.
I liked the Indian in the Cupboard. I kept wanting to call it the Indian in My Cupboard when I referred to it this week. But that's like Polly in My Pocket, but that's not right either. What there was definitely some toy that was in my, or not just my pocket, a pocket.
I don't know. Maybe it'll come back to us throughout this and we'll suddenly shout.
I want Indian in the Cupboard, as cute as can be. Don't you want to come play with me? There's definitely about three different things from the 90s that are merging together in my head.
Yeah.
I do. And I will make clear to any listener who doesn't know the Indian in the Cupboard series, it's like a little model of, I guess, a stereotypical Indian from Cowboy and Indians, like little plastic, I think, play figure who comes to life. Rather than like an actual full-bodied human who's been locked in a kid's cupboard, which would be a very dark premise for a kid's book. But this is a fun cupboard, and as far as I remember, the toy quite enjoys being locked in the cupboard, I think. I think maybe, I'm not sure, I can't remember very much about it, to be honest.
All I know is that it's a magical cupboard that brings toys to life. So that's,
Also, she wrote I, Houdini, which is one my sister liked when she was young, which is definitely a crafty animal book. I think possibly a hamster who is able to escape from things
Oh.
like Houdini.
You know, that does sound vaguely familiar now that you mention it. But yeah, I didn't. I had no idea that she wrote The Indian in the Cupboard, because this was the book that of hers that I read several times. It was on my
Oh.
one of my repeat reads, because yeah, it came out in 1997, and that was pretty much exactly the right age for. I was about 9 or 10, so
Can you remember where you came across it? Like if it was bought for you or?
no idea, no, just yeah, I don't have any memories of acquiring it, just that I it was just one of the books I had that I enjoyed but also found unsettling.
Okay, yeah,
So
I was going to ask if you found it scary when you were a kid.
I mean, I think yeah, I think I found it funny, but also definitely had an edge of disturbing content to it, which it does on a reread too. So.
I mean, before we started recording, I said I felt it was like the League of Gentlemen for kids, in that it's on that knife edge between being comedy that sometimes tips into horror. And also, it's got these kind of broad, slightly grotesque characters. And that it's got slightly, and it's got a mean streak to it that it sometimes pulls you up short with something that's quite cruel, I guess.
My copy has a quote on the back that says a worthy successor to Roald Dahl, so
Yeah, I can see that.
But yeah, I just have yeah. It's an interesting book, an interesting combination of this quite kind of broad characters and kind of quite dark comedy, and then kind of theology as well. But the basic plot is that this young couple have unexpected twins, and the first twin is a beautiful, placid, gurgling baby who delights everyone who sees her, and the second is a screaming terror who gives the nurse, the delivering nurse, a bite on the thumb so severe she nearly bleeds to death. And this is a they call them Jill and Jane, in the kind of hope that they can instill ordinariness into them. But when it comes to their christening, I think it's probably worth reading the christening aloud,
Okay.
as it's from wherever you see fit in the chapter.
Okay, well, so the christening of, well, I'll start with the christening of Jill, or that's what the mother wants to call Jill. So the vicar says, "I name this child," he began. Then he looked down and saw the baby's face for the first time. Its heavenly blue eyes were looking straight into his. He gasped. For some moments, there was complete silence. Then the vicar did a thing he'd never done before. He clasped the baby to his heart and began to cry. "Angela!" he sobbed. "No, Jill!" cried both the parents, but it was too late. He had named the baby Angela, which of course means angel in Latin, which all vicars are supposed to speak fluently. Most of them don't, but this one did. When the hubbub had died down and the two godparents had managed to pry Jill, now Angela, out of the vicar's arms, it was Jane's turn. Reluctantly, Mr. Cuthbertson Jones turned to the other godmother, who stamped her cigarette out on the flagstones, coughed wetly, wiped the palms of her hands down the sides of her dirty old skirt, and grabbed Jane, who was securely swaddled in a shawl so she couldn't use her nails. The tramp lady didn't bother looking at her godchild. She just thrust the bundle straight into the arms of the vicar and took another cigarette from behind her ear. The godfather, meanwhile, was furtively swigging from his bottle behind the nearest pillar. The vicar looked like a person who has just opened the most wonderful present he has ever had in his life. And before even getting used to that, is given another. And what name is to be given to this divine and wondrous creature? He asked with a smile of radiant happiness on his face. Jemima or something, said the godmother. Poor Mr. and Mrs. Cuthbertson Jones were getting quite unnerved. Jane! Jane! They shouted, so that everyone in the church jumped. The vicar held the baby as before, looked up to heaven with a seraphic smile, and began. I name this baby. And then he looked down into a pair of glittering little green eyes. This good and kindly man had never been able to believe that anyone could be really bad, let alone a tiny newborn baby. But now he saw for the very first time that he had been wrong. The shock was so awful that he dropped the baby straight into the font, which was an old-fashioned deep one. She made a terrific splash and disappeared under the water. Before anyone could move, she popped straight up again like a cork and let out a shriek of outrage so loud that everyone around the font fell back, holding their ears. At the end of this piercing shriek, she had to take in a breath. In the silence while she did this, a single word, like a cry of anguish, pierced the church from end to end. Diabola! The vicar, unfortunately, was also fluent in Greek. Diabola means evil one in Greek. Coming from this good man who had never sworn in his life, this terrible cry amounted to the worst word he had ever said. But with it, he had named the baby.
Thank you, Adam. the context with that is that Mr. Cuthbertson Jones had had to find some pay some people under a bridge to be Jane, now Diabola's godparents. No one would take up the task. The parents are, despite very much wanting to call their children Jill and Jane, now have to accept that the vicar knows best, and they are called Angela and Diabola. So we get some details of Diabola's general activities: spitting, punching, throwing things, throttling the cat, throwing the dead cat at her father, trying to cut off her sister's fingers, nail scissors, normal things.
It basically quickly becomes, we need to talk about Diabola. there's even less subtlety than there was, and we need to talk about Kevin, about the fact that she is pure evil. There's definitely no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. She is a little creature of pure malice and spite.
Yeah. So they kind of went, as they're kind of babies and they get toddlers, they kind of start keeping them separate because so that Mr. Cuthbertson Jones can deal with Diabola and Mrs. CJ can look after Angela. But this kind of plan falls apart when they realise that Angela actually loves her sister and wants to spend time with her, despite everything. So they go shopping with both the twins, and Diabola is trussed up in a scarf. They sort of lulled into a false sense of security because she's She's surprisingly quiet being next to Angela, but they end up leaving her alone for a moment, at which point she disentangles her from the scarf and starts flinging projectiles of frozen fish and chicken at everyone nearby. The police end up getting called, and Mrs. Cuthbertson Jones ends up being jailed for a month. So in this period, they farm Angela out to the neighbors, and Mr. CJ is left alone with Diabola, and has invented her techniques for managing her, such as lassoing her and putting her in the big cage, which is like it says, like a tall playpen, only it's a cage with a barred lid made of strong, lightweight metal of the sort they make space rockets out of. At this point, kind of, he's becoming kind of convinced that Diabola is a punishment specifically to him for some unspecified misdeeds. And he ends up calling the vicar again to, in desperation, to see if they can exorcise Diabola, which she finds very amusing. The vicar's a recurring character in this book, as they become. He sort of it comes drawn into the sort of theological conundrum of these twins, of the fact that one of them is pure evil and one of them is pure good. They kind of find some sort of techniques for managing Diabola. They realize that the twins kind of need each other in some way, and that Angela can have this kind of mollifying effect on her sister. And the other thing that helps is that Diabola discovers drawing. When the twins start school, and the parents are absolutely convinced that she will be expelled on the first day, instead, we get another eccentric background character of the headmistress, who finds Diabola's drawings of someone being electrocuted in the electric chair quite avant-garde and expressive, and hails her as a genius.
Yeah,
I think.
I really enjoyed that bit actually. I'll just describe the picture. The most horrendous picture lay before her. It showed a big wooden chair with a man in it. He had straps on his arms and legs. On his head, he wore a sort of cap with string-like things coming out of it. The man's face wore a very unhappy expression. Diabola was busy drawing in zigzag lines like lightning flashes coming out of him. "Diabo!" Miss Applebaum cried. "Whatever's that?" Diabola ignored her. She put the finishing touches to the zigzags and then took a plain pencil from her lap and wrote underneath the picture, "Death in the 'lectric chair." So her spelling is like death in there, let kick, chur. There we go.
when yeah when the headmistress, Mrs. Kirkbright, is convinced that she comes from a very progressive home where she's exposed to all the stimulating horrors of the world in order to develop her art.
Yeah, like she's have grown up in Frank Zappa's home in California in the 60s. Although I will note that Moon Unit Zappa and the rest of them Dweezil and co have turned out to be seemingly very well adjusted human beings, so they haven't ended up like Diabola.
I think I was thinking about this book, and like, I think one of the reasons that like I enjoyed it and like I like wanted to reread it is like the fact that it has such like a horrible little girl in it. Like I think it would I would have not been interested in it if like it'd been like Angela had been a girl and Diabolo had been a boy. Like, you know, we kind of played into the kind of, you know, sugar and spice and all things nice and slugs and snails and puppy dog tails. But actually, we get a girl who is slugs and snails and puppy dog tails, which is kind of unusual. And
That's true. I mean, it's like a sort of twisted 90s update of My Naughty Little Sister, if you ever read those when you were little. My extremely spelt with an X, naughty little sister.
So yeah, they're they've managed they've kind of partitioned off like half of the room now into a cage so that Angela and Diabola can kind of share a room, but the cage has an enormous blackout curtain that they can lower to if because Diabola hates being ignored, so that way they can kind of stop her having a tantrum to a certain extent.
Yeah, I like how this book manages to kind of justify and get the reader on side with all of these horrendous childcare techniques that would have social services dashing around in an instant. But because Diabola is constructed as wholly evil, you're like, yeah, lock her in a cage, that sounds good.
Well, there's a bit like when at the beginning when they're babies when they're trying to figure out how to feed Diabola and they without getting food all over everything and it says before long decided they had better feed Jane outdoors to save cleaning up. But that didn't work. The neighbours thought they were killing her and called the RSPCC. When the RSPCC arrived in the shape of a nice young woman, she took one look at Jane and decided cruelty to children might, in some cases, be justified.
So wrong.
Damn.
Actually, let's do the texture of the week. Texture.
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 Texture of
The week.
The week.
What was that clackety thing you have?
That's a long arm stapler.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Just the one arm.
A long arm. One long
One
arm.
long arm.
Yeah. The long arm of the stapler.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what did you have in mind?
Well, kind of like the infant Diabola's mouth, really, because she's described, I guess you can easily picture like a little gummy baby's mouth, but she's described as having these sort of fang-like teeth as well, which, you know, bites and clamps onto things when she's little.
Oh, you know what? Mackie horrified me the other day by showing me the picture of a mo what was it? Was it a moray?
Like moray
Like,
eel.
yeah. Was it? No, a lamprey.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a lamprey's mouth?
Yeah, I think I have seen photos of a lamprey's mouth.
Yeah. I don't know. That's just what it made me think of. Because
Yeah.
it's
A horrible maw.
a horrible moor, yeah.
Yeah. I rather like the early stuff with her eating and feeding and generally being mucky. I don't know. I found it quite. It made me think of like Jan Trankmar's Little Ottic, which is, Shank Meyers film about a tree baby on Tassenek, you know, who ends up eating everything, including its parents. And Shrankmar uses, I mean, it's probably some kind of pork flesh, sadly. However much I love pigs, I do enjoy Shrankmar's films, but it has a has a horrible tongue, and sort of sharp gnashing teeth and gobbles everything up. And that is sort of how I was imagining her as a baby.
Yeah.
What about you?
I had their twinish language.
Cool. Yeah, so order street texture. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, which they develop for a while. Diabola insists on only in talking in twinish to Angela, who will then translate. Angela talks it too, but hers is a much nicer version, whereas Diabola's is sort of, well, I'm going to have some examples.
Yes.
Spitball gut snuggle willy slime bag. and chunk piddle Jane is on when she's asking Angela where, this is in the next chapter, when her mother tries to start calling her Jane again. Chunk piddle Jane. I just really enjoyed. Yeah.
Cause there aren't lots of kind of descriptive passages in the book. So I guess some of the text does come more through the dialogue and the images than the language.
Yeah, and I think this book is definitely helped by the illustrations, which are very good.
Yeah, they're a bit Quentin Blake like.
Yeah.
By Klaas Verplank, possibly.
Oh yeah, Verplank. Yeah. Oh, that's the cover illustration. Is that the... that's all the illustrations.
Well, oddly, on the cover, they look older than they ever get to in the book.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah, they look taller. So I think by the end of the book, they're probably about sort of 10, maybe? 9 or 10. Whereas, yeah, on the cover, they look like they should be 12, 13.
Yeah. it's because things really start to go off the rails when Mr. Cuthbertson Jones finally snaps. He's taking Diabola to school, and she's being awful as usual, but he loses his temper with her and locks her in her cage, and when she complains that they always take Angela to school, he says, "Angela deserves to be taken to school and loved and looked after. If anything happened to Angela, we'd care." But after that, he's kind of overwhelmed with guilt and anguish and leaves. Clears off, and soon after that the house falls down, Mrs. CJ consults the vicar again, and he says, well, yeah, they the physics itself has been unbalanced by the phenomenon of the twins, you know, kind of without the goodness of Mr. Cuthbertson Jones to balance out Diabola, you know, the house couldn't withstand the pressure, and it fell down. So it kind of, she's sort of getting more sort of supernatural by the day, and kind of less just like a little girl.
Yeah, it becomes increasingly like The Omen or The Exorcist or something like that.
Yeah, she mentions she does a point and kind of leaves a mark on her mother's arm. But, The family kind of moved to a flat at the top of a kind of dingy tower block, and they kind of put Diabolo out up on the roof in the rain while the vicar helps get the flat together.
Yeah, it feels like they've suddenly been relocated into a Philip Ridley book.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, they're in what's it called? Mercedes Ice now.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. But without any glittery, fantastical.
Without the mitigating whimsy, basically.
The mitigating glamour whimsy, yeah. So yeah, it's just this horrible, horrible damp flat. Lynn Reed Banks has a kind of dig at the council, as we
Yeah, there's a bit of a dig at the council, local government, isn't there?
Yeah. not caring what happens to these people. They sort of managed to get it kind of habitable with the vicar's help. Not before kind of Diabolo jumps on the bed and manages to knock herself out on the ceiling, but it's fine.
There's a quite upsetting image of her just as she makes impact, whacking her head.
Yeah. They're still only six at this point. It's becoming. It's saying that they're becoming less and less like ordinary children, it's sort of accelerating, and like particularly Diabolo is like growing like bigger and stronger. Like she's always been bigger and stronger than her age anyway, but it's kind of getting faster. And kind of when they go to sleep that night, Mrs. Cuffers and Jones feels the whole kind of tower block shiver as if Diabola might pull the whole thing down.
And Diabola seems to realise that her powers are growing stronger, right? And takes to the roof to try them out on unsuspecting passers-by.
Yeah. I mean, before that, there's a slightly upsetting bit where like, sort of the morning after they've moved in and Mrs. Cuffston Jones is cooking, but, like, there's no working light, so she has the door open and the kind of two sort of drunk intimidating men kind of come into the flat and sort of like trying to take her sausages and stuff, and Diabola accidentally does a good thing and uses her powers on them and kind of bores with her eyes into them that they feel as if they've been shot and then like flee.
It is quite an upsetting sequence. Like, there's a real sense of threat, and it is like a little home invasion sequence, basically. It's quite underplayed. Like, nothing. They don't end up, apart from being really intimidating and unpleasant, they don't end up, you know, they're probably stopped before they could do anything more. But it is quite disturbing, that bit.
Yeah. I think that was another bit that stuck in my head, that bit. Diabola realizes she has these powers and she wants to go to school because she wants to do more of her horrible drawings, but where they're staying now is far away from the school, so she goes and uses her new powers on someone to get him to give her his money, and kind of gets in a taxi to school. When she's in her drawing lesson that day, she finally goes too far, even for the headmistress, by drawing the tower block on fire with her mother and sister on the roof. I'm not quite sure why this is too much for the headmistress.
I don't know. Maybe it's because, like, she specifically draws her mother and sister on fire. Like, before, I guess it seemed more confined to the imagination. You know, like, random person in the electric chair or whatever, whereas now it seems deliberately targeted towards her mother and sister. Maybe it starts actually disturbing her, I guess.
But she manages to set the piece of paper on fire with her mind.
It goes into kind of Stephen King fire starter territory now.
I'll just read the bit at the end of this chapter because it's quite good. Diabolla watched the spreading flames for another few moments. Then, quite calmly, she gathered up her art materials and put them into her school bag. She glanced at the picture of the block of flats. It had a hole the size of her fist burnt into the middle of it, but the two little figures on the roof were still there. With the real flame spreading and the smoke half choking her, she quickly stuck her forefingers into the pots of red and orange paint. There was no time to use brushes. She finger-painted big fat flames around the figures. She smeared the red and orange all over them until they disappeared. Then she lifted the picture and threw it onto the blazing floor. Real flames, paint flames. You can no longer tell which was which.
She does have the spirit of an artist. There are times where you can't help but kind of... I mean, I'm not saying I'm rooting for her, but, there are times where you get it. You get where she's coming from.
She just needs to have all the art material she could possibly desire and people to bring her food and keep her safe and warm, and then she'll be fine.
Well, she basically probably grows up to become the Chapman brothers, right?
Exactly.
Pretty much. who I will say whose art is not suitable for work if you want to explore that reference. If you're over 18, you can, and some of it's quite entertaining, but not really childfriendly. But basically the kind of art that she would make.
Yeah. I was wondering if there was a Francis Bacon reference as well with the electric chair one.
Yeah,
with the Pope.
Some of it does sound quite Francis Bacon-like. That's true.
Yeah. but yeah, now she's really she really knows like what power she's got. And meanwhile, Angela is like, we need to find Dad. Like, we need to rebalance this situation. Diabolla is on the roof, like practicing her powers. She's like making cars swerve together and people keel over in the street. But she realizes that Angela has this kind of neutralizing effect on her, that, she can't be as bad as she wants to be when Angela's around. And she kind of feels Angela's neutralizing presence getting close, coming up the stairs. And before Angela gets the roof, she asks her mother what her first name is. And she says it's Mwaitho. Perhaps this is what an AI told me is how this name might be pronounced. So apologies to any Welsh listeners.
AI wouldn't lie. They're not able to.
Yeah. and Angela says, it means soft. You mustn't be soft, mummy. There's a lot of stuff about names in this book, and what names mean and the power of using the right name. But up on the roof, Diabolla shows Angela that the people she's stricken, and kind of Angela makes them get up and dance. And Diabolla's like, next time. But then when Angela turns her back to look at the street, she feels this kind of wave of badness behind her, kind of a moment before Diabolla's hands would have reached to push her over the edge. And she sort of ducks out the way, and instead it's Diabolla who flips over the edge and Angela hanging onto her wrists. Do you want to read that bit, maybe, on page 208?
Yeah, sure. Diabo, she got out between her teeth. Stop it, I can't hold you. Diabolla didn't answer. She was pressing the soles of her shoes against the wall, trying to climb up. Angela pulled, scraping her wrists more. Then her wrists came clear of the rough bricks. She was on her knees now, edging back, pulling Diabola up. Diabola's face came up slowly over the broken parapet. Their eyes came level. Angela saw Diabola's face change. She saw the terror in it disappear under something stronger. Angela looked into her twin's eyes. She couldn't even see her fear now. All she could see was hate. All she could feel was Diabola's wish to destroy her. Angela used every bit of power she had. She wanted, at that moment, she truly wanted only not to let Diabola go. The feeling of wanting that was so strong she forgot all pain, all fear. She forgot that Diabola had tried to kill her. She held on, she pulled, but suddenly she felt that Diabola was not letting her pull her up. Diabola was pulling back! In that second, Angela knew the awful truth. Diabola was still trying to pull her over. Diabola wanted to destroy Angela more than she wanted to save herself. Angela let go. She didn't decide to. It just happened. The sheer shock loosened her grip on Diabola's wrists, and they slipped through her hands. For an instant, Diabola's face hung there, her eyes wide of disbelief, staring into hers. Then she fell. Down. 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 Like the brick. Down to the pavement, screaming all the way. And then, splat.
Yeah.
Yeah, there aren't many kids' books that kill off a small child that, like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Listener, I was quite shocked.
Yeah. Yeah, did you not? You didn't think it would end that way?
I didn't think it would go that far, if I'm honest. Yeah.
So the last chapter is called Balance. And when Angela wakes up, she's not the same Angela that she was. And instead of two blue eyes, she has one green eye. And the vicar says to my wife, there's no such thing in the world as pure good or pure evil. For a little while, there was no exception, but it only proved the rule. Perhaps that's why it was allowed to happen. Mr. Cuthbertson Jones returns, and his name, it turns out, is Curra, which says it's from the Latin to run, but he never lived up to it again. And Angela is renamed Jill. And I'll just read the last passage. And Jill? Well, she was now an ordinary, normal little girl, with good and bad parts mixed up in her. Her parents adored her, and on the whole, she made them happy and proud. But every now and then, she would have flashes of bad temper and outbursts of bad behaviour. And at these times, she developed a squint. Her blue eye would turn inwards and look at her green eye. The green eye would look back at her blue eye and grow slitty and glittery. The two eyes would glare at each other across the top of her nose. Usually, the blue eye would get the better of the green eye. But not always. Just like the rest of us. Yeah, that is Angela and Diabola.
It's interesting to me that we spent a lot more time talking about Diabola than Angela, which maybe it's testimony to the allure of evil or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, she is the star of the book, you know? Poor Angela is not very interesting.
I find it quite funny that their mother finds it worse when there's a sort of a short-lived period where sort of Diabola sort of pretends to be good and does a weird impression of Angela and sort of speaks in a kind of cutie pie voice, like lisping.
Yeah.
which is apparently even more unendurable than her regular self.
Yeah, there's also some kind of slightly amusing bits where the parents kind of get tired of people kind of fawning over Angela, and they're like, she's like, she's so beautiful and charming and adorable, and they're like, yeah, okay, anyway.
But yeah, I could see why you liked it as a kid. Like, it's quite fascinating, and it does feel faintly transgressive. Like, it must have been quite exciting to read as a kid.
Yeah, I think.
Like, maybe that's where it's similar to Roald Dahl, this sort of vague feeling that it's a bit illicit on some level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. But, yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, yeah, it's kind of interesting, like, nothing, like, Diabola does so much terrible things, but she's never cast out of the, like, family environment. She's, they just adapt to her until, well, when the dad runs away, but it's kind of, I don't know, yeah, it's kind of oddly comforting in a way.
Oh, I see. So as a kid you could be like, oh, even if I'm as bad as her, my parents won't give up on me.
They have to look after me. And
yeah.
Obviously not true. Yeah. The Cuffords and Joneses are a remarkably long suffering. I think it has this kind of ideal of, like, you know, the parents. The parents will always look after the child, no matter what she inflicts on them.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's quite different to Roald Dahl, whereas we discussed when we were talking about him, you know, a couple of months back, like, there's very often just outright abandonment in Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
Or parental figures dying, but really, adults are quite remarkably unreliable in Roald Dahl books.
Yeah. And I guess it's interesting that this is the rare children's book that has two parents in a kind of, well, for most of it, has two parents who are in a kind of functioning relationship with each other, you know, because, you know, a lot of children's books, you have one of the parents will have died or
not. That is true.
To kind of but yeah, it's kind of going in a, I'm kind of finding it hard to articulate exactly what I mean, but it's kind of, it's sort of stretching that parent-child relationship in a different way than,
yes,
it's more common in children's books.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, we've definitely sort of thoroughly spoiled this one, plot-wise. But really, it's just, you kind of know the way the plot's going. It's more just fun to read on a page-by-page level. There's a lot of good jokes, really.
Yeah, and the kind of enjoyment of seeing how the parents handle Diabola and, like, the contraptions they rig up to keep her in check and so on.
Yeah, it's good. It was fun.
That is an artifact from my childhood that I'm glad we got around to talking about.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad I read it. It cheered me up. It was a fun read.
Yeah. Thanks to my local charity shop for having it on the bookshelf. So I noticed it and remembered it. I was like, cool. Oh, yeah, should do that one. Yeah.
Right, do you want to run the credits?
Yeah. So our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Our outro's by Joe Kelly. We have details to their various websites and things in the show notes. You can leave us a review if you want on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast thing you use. We like seeing reviews. It's fun. And you can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast, and you get a bonus collage for each episode.
Oh, I'm excited about the collage for this one.
Yeah. So I need to make a collage. do you have an outro for us?
Oh, I do.
Do you have a sign off? Sorry.
Well, a sign off of sorts. I'll just say also follow us on Letterboxd.
Oh yeah.
Creepy Kids, because I set up an account on there where I was putting reviews of the films and the films, not the books, and that we've discussed along with a few others.
So it's, oh yeah, they're very good. Yeah,
it's just Still Scared. This.
Mm.
Still Scared, no underscores, no dots.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And don't obviously lock any small children in a cage. I guess unless they are the Antichrist, but
okay,
It's very unlikely.
Yeah. All right. See you next time, Spooky Kids.
Bye.
Bye.